Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of very good people involved. And, of course, the host and founder and guiding light of this affair is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. We have a special program for you today. As a matter of fact, Carol and the entire cast of characters are taking off, and I'll be here by myself having a conversation with two of the three members of a legendary rock band called Gun Hill Road. After 40 years after they had their one very big hit single back in 1973 called Back When My Hair Was Short, they got back in the studio and recorded a brand new album, a CD of 19 original tracks. It's called Every 40 Years.
Sometimes I think I'm alone. I think I'm the only one who's ever gotten old. But I should have known that it's the same sob story I was always told. But just like everybody else, I didn't listen when they whined. I had to find out for myself. You lose your body and your mind. Oh, everything passes, and now I need glasses. Oh, I can't see far, though I've traveled far and wide. I'm still a boy inside.
That's Gun Hill Road from their brand new album, Every 40 Years. The voices are Glenn Leopold, who wrote the song, and Paul Reich, their bass player, who sings one of the sets of lyrics there. And actually, that song would make a great theme song for this program. And certainly, I think you'll find their story quite interesting and very inspirational in terms of guys that had an experience together back in the early 70s and their early 20s, and then 40 years later got back together and did it again. And it's a story that is the stuff movies are made of. We have three men, Glenn Leopold, Steve Goldrich, and Paul Reich. And Gun Hill Road is back. The album is Every 40 Years. Now, when I was a DJ, a young 22-year-old disc jockey in New York City on a legendary station, WNEW-FM, I used to play them. I played a song called 42nd Street from their first album and got to know them a little bit. And really, really enjoyed their music. So when the decades went by and I found out that they had a new album, it was really a pleasure for me and kind of a personal, I can't even describe it. I sort of had a vicarious thrill, just as they did doing that, getting back involved with them. So we have the pleasure of talking with Glenn Leopold, who for this conversation is in California, where he currently lives, and Steve Goldrich, who still lives in New York. How did you come up with the name Gun Hill Road for a couple of kids from Mount Vernon? Steve?
We used to take the subway into the city, and as we were sitting waiting to get in, we would pass the street on a regular basis, and I think subliminally we always thought that was an interesting name. And when it came time to put a name together, it seemed to us it made some sense, and it sounded better than Mount Vernon.
Did the two of you know each other back in Mount Vernon when you were growing up, Glenn?
We did. Actually, I had a stepbrother, and we lived in the basement of this house. And Bobby knew Steve from high school. I'm a couple years older than Steve, but we did know each other in high school. I was just finishing up high school and then starting college, and Steve was still in high school. So we did know each other before we started doing stuff with the band.
Glenn, what type of a kid were you growing up in the 60s?
Oh, I guess you would call me sort of a nerdy little skinny kid. I liked science fiction and horror. I loved music, and especially the music of, I was a big Bobby V fan, Bobby V and Gene Pitney. I was a fan because they did such wonderful songs that were written by Carole King and Jerry Goffin and, you know, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and Burt Bacharach and Hal David. So I was really kind of into who wrote the songs And I was, you know, I liked, like I say, I liked music. I learned how to play guitar when I was 14 by using a Beatle book with all the tablature. So I went through, I just sat in my room and just played and played the chords, the Beatle chords, until I kind of knew what chords were. It was really fun, and it was for a kind of nerdy, skinny kid. It was really a great thing to feel like you had mastered something, as opposed to the world just being so big.
Steve, what kind of kid were you growing up in Westchester back in the 60s?
Well, I was very much into baseball, adored it, and very much into music. At that time, when I was a little boy, I used to go to my grandparents' house, and they would take the pots and pans out, and I would take spoons and hit them and, I guess, play along to some music. My mother taught piano, but as a typical mother, she probably couldn't teach me, and I gradually I graduated to hitting the piano literally or figuratively, because it wasn't as much fun sitting in the room playing, thrums, so to speak. And the great thing about piano is all the notes are there. If you hit the piano at some point, if you take your fingers, something's going to sound okay. And I started teaching myself that, and played in high school, actually after high school, got involved playing portable organ, and switched really more to piano, less regular keyboards. And when Glenn and I got together in the beginning, he was playing electric guitar and I was playing drums. That shared experience of loving very much similar groups like the Hollies and many of the vocal groups from the late 50s, early 60s, the Belmonts, etc., and really groups that we could sing along with, groups that had harmonies, and groups that had melodies that and hooks, essentially.
So you played the piano, but you didn't think of yourself as like a rock and roll piano player, or how did that happen?
For me, the piano was, and actually some of the influences relative to other people who played were people like Rod Argent from the Zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And the piano player from the Moody Blues, because for me, those two people embodied the kinds of piano playing that were very exciting. And when I learned how to play the lead and Go Now, I was just so happy that I said, this is it. I know how to play this now. Or, conversely, playing something that Rod Argent had played. So it was less rock and roll, although I think we called it rock and roll. And to me, it was sort of pop music.
Mm-hmm.
My pop music.
Yeah. My background is such that I consider everything rock. I consider most of the music today derivatives of rock. You know, back at WNEW-FM, where we first met each other, and I was playing your first album every day. I loved it. Those were the days when we could play whatever we wanted. And you had that song 42nd Street from the first album, which was your first single. Your piano in that is a major part of the song, and at the end of it, you're just banging those keys, very Jerry Lee Lewis-ish. I was stunned when I found out that you were self-taught, and I'm not even sure what self-taught means. It's hard enough to get kids to take their piano lessons, and I grew up when every kid had to carry their accordion around with them. If you remember back in the 50s, kids took accordion lessons and they carried their accordion wherever they went. You were into it on your own, huh?
Yeah, there was the passion of playing, I think, was the motivator for myself. I would speak for Glenn briefly and say for him as well. There was nothing that I enjoyed more than playing, and because I enjoyed it so much, my own self-taught style is my own self-taught style. So there are things that I did, and I guess still do intuitively, that other people perhaps wouldn't do. And when we would get reviewed, be it a live recording or let's say a record, when they would reference something I played and mention a Leon Russell or someone like that, I used to go, wow, for me, Leon Russell, if he walked in the room, I'd go, well, let me sit over in the corner so I don't bother you. So I think it has as much to do with just caring so much about it and wanting that to be the thing I was doing all the time. And that's, I guess, part and parcel of enjoying it so much, just that love of finding another thing that you found you could play easily, or something that you played and you go, whoa, where'd that come from?
I wonder about the piano. You see pianos today, you go into a restaurant, there's a guy playing a piano, and then you realize all of a sudden he's playing an organ, and then he's playing, a violin, and it's at the keyboard. We have all these electric pianos. How is the difference between these modern electronic pianos and the old-fashioned pianos that you would see in a concert, or that we would have had in our house? We had an upright piano as part of the furniture in our house.
And actually, I think everybody I knew, there was typically a piano in somebody's house. It was almost always out of tune. For me, the difference is simply a question of the response or touch. If you hit a regular piano key, one note as an example, there's a reaction depending on how hard you hit it. With an electronic version, it can approximate it, but from my perspective, it's not the same thing. So I have played, you know, many different types of electronic instruments, but at heart, I just prefer playing a real piano because there's something about it that has nuances, etc., in terms of the touch, in terms of the sound.
Glenn Leopold, you basically have a very interesting story that I would love to share with our listeners. How Gun Hill Road began.
I was going to school in the Midwest. I was at University of Missouri, and I'd been playing guitar since I was 14. And then every now and then I'd be writing songs and things like that. But I really started to get into the songwriting, you know, late in high school, and then when I was in college. And there was a guy that in my dorm who I managed a local group, and he heard me playing, and he liked one of the songs, and so this group out there actually recorded. It was really my first taste of someone performing one of my songs. I wasn't really thinking of myself as a performer particularly, but more as a songwriter, since, you know, songwriting was something I admired so much from all those times of, you know, listening to the Carole King songs and Burt Bacharach songs. And so somewhere along the line, I decided to go, you know, I was back in New York, and I was offered a contract with Tom Catalano and Neil Diamond. They were going to form a company together called Armada Productions, and Tom Catalano had produced all of Neil Diamond's, or most of his big hits. So they were going to sign me as a songwriter, and so I was going to transfer from University of Missouri back to NYU so I could do this contract and start working with these guys. And I met Neil Diamond in his apartment on the east side, and it was very exciting for somebody, you know, because Neil Diamond was like, you know, this was big time, and I saw his piano, and it was very interesting. But my cousin, who was a lawyer, looked at the contract and said, this is a terrible contract. They're going to pay you $100 a week, and if you show up late for the recording session, they can dock the $100, and so you shouldn't take this contract or whatever. And so I ended up not taking the contract, but I'd already transferred schools to go, you know, back to NYU and leave Missouri, where I had friends and where I, you know, was, you know, used to play, you know, play guitar in the hallways and stuff like that. But so there I was back in Manhattan. I was transferred schools, and I really didn't have anything, didn't know what to do next. So with a young boy's chutzpah, I decided to go to the Brill Building, or what is considered the Brill Building in New York, where all the songwriters would hang out. And Chip Taylor, who I knew not just because he wrote Wild Thing and Angel of the Morning, but because he wrote one of the favorite songs of the Hollies that I really liked, was I Can't Let Go, which was a great song. So I don't know how I decided to do this, but I went up and I sat in his waiting room of his office and asked if I could see him. And nice guy that he is, he actually saw me. I ended up playing songs for him. He was very encouraging, and he suggested that I go down to the Bitter End and start playing, see if I could get onto one of their Hootenanny nights, which was like, I think, a Tuesday night, and where I could play and maybe, you know, somebody would hear my songs. And so my mom ended up driving me down there, and she parked in front of the Bitter End. I said, don't worry, I'll go in there. I'll probably be out right away. They probably won't like it. So I got up and I played a couple of songs, and Paul Colby, who was the manager of the Bitter End, which was a big place, you know, a big club. I mean, Woody Allen that played there, it was just a very famous place, said he really liked the songs. There was something about the songs he liked. So I ran out. I told my mom to park the car. I ended up playing on that Hootenanny night, and I started playing these, you know, like once a week. You know, I was also going to school at NYU at the same time. And then Steve came down at one point and started playing along with one of the songs on the piano. They had a piano in the back, I believe, and it really sounded good because Steve had this certain style, and it really plussed the music. And that's really how it all started. And then as Paul sort of became the, you know, was managing me, and then it became a group as Steve and I were singing harmony, and then we had a bass player, so we had three-part harmony. And, of course, we had, like, the Everly Brothers and the Hollies and groups that had harmony, so it was great. I was writing the songs, and everybody was singing them. I was singing the lead, and then we got a record deal. Paul would bring record companies down to hear us play, and, you know, there were a few ones that passed on us, but then Mercury Records signed us, and all of a sudden we had a record deal, And, you know, it was just like right out of college. We were having a record came out in 1971. So for me, it was just like a dream come true. And I'm sure for Steve also, it was just like surreal.
Steve, what was it like, the culture being at the bitter end circa 1971?
Well, when you walked into the bitter end, when we walked into the bitter end, obviously for me in 1969, it was the big time. You sort of knew that when you were there because they had such well-known performers. And because the club was so small and it was so intimate, there was an immediate sense that you were not just playing at some place, but playing at a really important place. The club itself only held 200 and something people, so it was very intimate, very dark, just benches essentially. And since it had no liquor, it was only ice cream sodas and things like that, it tended to be a very mellow crowd. So when you walked in, there was always this sense of a community-type atmosphere, which for us was terrific because we were as much an audience as we were people who performed, and we loved to hang around and watch. And whether it was just a handful of people or there were just loads of people watching whomever the performer was, there was something about it that was so much, so indicative and so much a part of the culture of Greenwich Village in those days. That we really couldn't stay away. And the entire area surrounding the Bitter End, Bleecker Street, etc., this is before NYU really ate up a lot of the village, was very quaint and very bohemian. And when you arrived down there, it was very common for young, you know, guys and girls to hang around the village because you really felt like you were a part of something very different than the rest of the city.
I remember the Bitter End as having, it was bristling with potential because it was a showcase club that the record labels used to bring their big new acts for the media to see. That's why I was there, because I was on the air at WNEW, as I said. I was a DJ. I had influence. And you're constantly being invited for free to come to the Bitter End to see new acts that they had just signed that went on to be superstars. And I saw many of those concerts that that you guys opened at. Glenn, did you have the feeling when this was happening that you were on the verge of the big time, that you were in a situation that was historic, or did you just not realize it when it was happening and you just did it?
Well, I mean, we knew that it was fun. I mean, personally, I don't know if we felt like we were on the cusp of, you know, breaking through to anything, but like Steve was saying, I mean, we loved being in the audience, watching other people. I saw the Everly Brothers play there. They were like idols of mine. I mean, it was just amazing to me. Ricky Nelson, I mean, these are people that we had grew up watching. I mean, and then, as you say, the showcase place was amazing. James Taylor was there promoting his first album, the Apple album. There was nobody in the audience. I think Steve and I were, you know, were probably maybe two of maybe 10 people. And then a month, 4 months later, the Sweet Baby James album or something was out, and there were lines around the block at another club. So it was, you had the sense of discovery that, I mean, anything could happen. And yes, it could happen to you. I mean, we would have paid Mercury to put us on the label. I mean, this is the kind of, you know, we were so excited to do music and, you know, to do our own music that we were just thrilled. But, you know, in retrospect now, I've had a friend of mine said, oh, Glenn, you were really back in the 70s when music was still fun, you know, before it all changed and it was still fun. And it was true. Seals and Cross played across the street. There were jazz clubs. It was a big familial kind of feeling. It wasn't that we had a, you know, sleep down there in the village, but we just, you know, you were part of it, and you were part of the creative energy, which was so great, and I don't know if that can ever be duplicated again.
How did Back When My Hair Was Short become a hit?
Well, this is an interesting story. The Back My Hair Was Short, the album cut, which was on the second album, the eponymous album, Gun Hill Road, on Buddha, was actually written because there was a producer who was doing a documentary about Randall's Island, and he sort of wanted a song for that. And Randall's Island had been sort of a fiasco rock concert thing where people got ripped off. And so I had started working on a song where, you know, people love to rip, you know, they have long hair, they're like hippies, but they love to rip off each other. And it was sort of cynical. And it had sort of a slower beat than the single originally would have. And it was sung by our bass player, Gil. This was like the one song that he would sing on stage with us. And we had it in our repertoire. And it was on the album and really didn't think that much about it. It got, you know, FM play the album. I think you were probably playing the second album, some of the tracks. But Neil Bogart was the head of Buddha Kama Sutra Records then. And he was a fantastic promo guy, record promotional guy. And he one day said that he felt that Back My Hair Was Short, if the tempo was sped up, and there were some drug references in the lyrics about them because the kids were taking drugs, that if that was done, he felt it could be a hit. And of course, you know, being the serious artist that I was at that time, and you know, being the singer-songwriter, I said, oh no, that's absolutely out of the question. I can't change my words, and I sort of left it at that. And then I was at home, sort of, you know, wandering around. I'm thinking, it sort of became a challenge. And I said, okay, well, maybe I could do this. And all of a sudden, I was a White Sox sport, you know, wore pointed shoes and peg pants. And I started changing the lyrics so that, the gist of it sort of remained. It wasn't quite as hard-edged, cynical-wise. And Neil brought in Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise, who had, I guess, discovered Kiss, or they discovered them later. And they went on to do Stories and Gladys Knight and the Pips. But they were young producers, and he entrusted them with producing this, single where the Back My Hair Was Short with the new lyrics, and it was sped up, and there was a calliope in it. And it came out, and all of a sudden it was going up the charts. So if you thought we were gobsmacked before, then we really were amazed when that started happening, because it was just, like, incredible to us. I mean, I was 25 years old, and hearing this song being played the summer of 73, you know, driving to the beach or driving everywhere, I mean, it was just like an out-of-body experience. It was amazing.
What a wonderful song. Do you remember it? I'm sure a lot of people listening right now are going, oh yeah, I remember that song. 1973, Gun Hill Road, their one and only big AM hit single. They had two FM favorites in terms of albums, and that's the song that was remixed and turned into an up-tempo, kind of a cleaner, not that it was dirty, but they were kind of edgy for those days, and they cleaned it up and had an appropriate song for the masses, and then went on to be considered a one-hit wonder. We're talking with Glenn Leopold and Steve Goldrich from Gun Hill Road upon the release of their new album called Every 40 Years, appropriately titled. And let me tell you, we've got plenty more conversation from these inspirational gentlemen coming up on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, in just a moment.
But no one knew what they stood for.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I prepare for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison, a special edition of A Touch of Gray, talking to Glenn Leopold and Steve Goldrich of the legendary band Gun Hill Road. And those of you who've been listening have heard we played a bit of Back When My Hair Was Short, which was their one big hit single. And we're going to be talking to Steve Goldrich in a moment, how he felt back being a kid, basically, having a hit. But I do want to mention, if you're interested in the music of Gun Hill Road, if you'd like to see a video about their history, if you'd like to find out how you can purchase their old albums, and certainly their new one, Every 40 Years, 19 original tracks, go to their website, GunHillRoadMusic.com. That's GunHillRoadMusic.com. I'm Michael Harrison, and now let's continue our conversation. We pick it up with Steve Goldrich talking about Back When My Hair Was Short. And Steve, what was it like to have a hit record? How did it feel? How did it feel being, you know, 22 or 23 years old and having your song on the radio and being on the Billboard charts?
It was stunning. It was stunning. I remember sitting in front of my parents, my, you know, house, apartment, and we used to be able to get KBW, the big clear channel station from Buffalo, and it was on their rotation, and I would sit with a portable radio or in the car right in front of my house, And then I would hear the intro, which was the piano. And I would, even to this day, I still jump sometimes when I hear it because I don't know it's going to come on. And all of a sudden to realize that not only are we on the charts, which I think we hit at 88 or something because Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise, who produced the single, had it laminated, which I, of course, still have. It was otherworldly. It really was. It was. There was something about it that, as amazing as it was very difficult to process because nobody can prepare themselves to literally be in that world the way we got into it, even though we had two albums out. And, yeah, it was from another dimension. It is within me, as I'm sure it is with Glenn, hearing the song on the radio every week, wanting to get Billboard, Cashbox, and Record World, which, of course, were the three trades then, and seeing what was happening, staying on top of it with Buddha Records, seeing what was happening with promotion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Glenn, what happened to Gil? How'd Paul get in there? And then how did it feel having it all just dissipate? And what did you do about it?
Well, first, the Gil part of the equation is that Gil is a very nice guy. He was younger than Steve and I, and he you know, had a really good voice and was very enthusiastic. But you know, Steve and I have I guess we call it kind of crazy personalities. We're kind of like finish each other's sentences, and we're sort of like some kind of twisted Abbott and Costello. But Gil was just always sort of a bit of an outsider. I don't know if this was self-imposed or he just felt he couldn't get things out with Steve and I, you know, having such dominant personalities or whatever. But for some reason, Gil just, you know, it just became sort of, you never could tell, you know, when he might show up, and we're always kind of worrying about, where he would be and where is he. And because he didn't really hang out with Steve and I, we would sort of get there and then he would wander off. And so it was more of a question of just unpredictability. It wasn't a question of talent or not being a nice person or whatever. And so when we looked for a new bass player, a sound guy at the bitter end had recommended Paul Reich, who was a very low-key, laconic, but really nice guy who's, you know, a very good guitar player. So that all fit in. Then he went off to Colorado after playing with us for about a year. He went to Colorado, and we had a couple of gigs coming up. And Paul called us and said, you know, I really like that here. I want to stay there. And we didn't, you know, want to say like, no, you can't. You got to come back. And we just wished him well. And we ended up getting another bass player. So that's the answer to that part of the question.
Emotionally, Glenn, how did it feel when it started to slip away?
Well, it didn't feel good. But you know, we were hopeful that the second single, we had high hopes going in. But Ford DeSoto Cadillac, the second single, did nothing. I mean, I don't think it got played anywhere. Maybe in Steve's house and my house, but nothing happened. And then Kern and Wise had produced that also. It could be also because Neil Bogart left Buddha, and so that driving force of promotion was no longer there. But it did not do anything. And then we re-recorded another song from the second album, She Made a Man Out of Me, with Kerner and Wise producing, and that one did nothing. I don't recall it getting added to any stations. It was kind of very disheartening. I know Steve was really disappointed. And you know, and so was I. And then the more disappointment came later when we, you know, Paul Colby was trying to get us another record deal, and then we tried, you know, on our own and just interviewing with a lot of different people and playing songs. I kept writing songs, we kept doing them, but you know, doing some demos, but nothing happened. And by 1976, Steve and I were down to a duo. We were playing some college concerts. It was just he and I. And it was really coming. We would talk on the phone every day like two little old ladies saying, what are we going to do? You know, one's going to sign us. And it's kind of like the writing was on the wall. Something was going to have to give. Steve was working for his dad's chemical company. And so I went out to California. But it was definitely pretty depressing when the two follow-up songs, nothing happened, and you feel like you cracked the door open and had it sort of slammed on your fingers. But, you know, we were young, and, you know, you have to be resilient. You know, the world doesn't always do what you want it to do. And we'd had so much fun doing what we're doing. I mean, you can't really be upset when you've had an experience that, you know, that most people, would give their right arm to even have. So I don't even always think of it as a one-hit wonder. I almost think like, well, is it better to have experienced it and then have it sort of taken away, or to never experience it at all? And I would never say, you know, I would not want to have experienced it. It was great. And so, and then that set the stage for what was to come.
Steve, how did that impact your life for the next three decades?
The end, which was as organic as it can be, because Glenn and I think I can say with 100% certainty, have never had as much as an argument. I mean, you know, in all the years we've known each other. And it wasn't under duress or rancor that it ended. It ended because we had done everything that seemed that conceivably we could have done. When it ended, it was, and it piled up for me anyway. I played with some other people, did some recording, but there was something disconcerting about having a part of my life that existed for 7 years go away. And during that period, when I was thinking, well, gee, what else, you know, would I be doing insofar as music, I did some stuff, but I didn't find it to be as satisfying, and ultimately backed away a little bit, got involved doing some things. I wrote a theme for the New Jersey Devils, which they used for a bit, and, you know, got involved some other recordings, but it didn't have the same appeal.
Well, okay, well, let's fast forward. You ran a company, which you still are involved in, obviously. Glenn, you went on to wind up in the animation business, but I mean, you wrote Popeye cartoons and things of that nature, which is pretty cool. All of a sudden, now you're back in the studio making a new record. What drove that? Was that to relive your youth? Was that to just get it out of your system? Was it to make it big time and become a superstar? What were you guys talking about when it came down to actually committing to going in the studio and making a new album?
Well, it was nothing planned like that. I mean, really, it came about totally by accident. I mean, Steve was doing his business and raising two kids, and I was, you know, writing at Hanna-Barbera and other studios, and we'd see each other when I would go back east to visit my mom and stuff, and we'd see each other briefly and, you know, talk here and there. But basically, we had sort of lives that were just going in their own directions. One day I got a call from a friend of mine who lives in New Jersey, and he said, they're doing this tribute to your old manager, Paul Colby, at this club called Outposts in the Burbs in Montclair, New Jersey. And so my friend said, why aren't you playing it? I said, well, because I don't know about it, number one. So I said, what's it all about? And he said, well, here's the name of the woman, you should call her. So I immediately called Steve, and I said, Steve, you know, there's this thing going on, it's a tribute for Paul, would you want to do it? And so Steve said, sure, that would be great. So I called up, and I talked to Al Mercuro, who was running Outposts in the Burbs, and I said, would you want us to play? And he said, oh, I would love for you guys to play. So then, of course, you come to the realization, what have we done? We haven't played for 38 years or 35 years. I've been on stage. So Steve and I started sending Steve the lyrics, and he had some of the lyric sheets and the chord sheets. And so then he got a hold of Paul Reich, who was living out on Long Island, and they started rehearsing without me because I was in California. And then we finally, you know, made a plan for me to get together about a week or so before the concert where we'd all get together. And, of course, I remember going to Steve's house, and I'm thinking, what if this really sounds bad? Was this a mistake? You know, was this something we shouldn't have done? And we started rehearsing, and we started doing 42nd Street, the first song, and Steve started playing the chords, and I started singing the lead, and we started singing the harmony, and it sounded just like, and Steve's wife said, that sounds really good. And it was like swimming. You know, you jumped in the pool, and all of a sudden you're swimming again. It was like, it really was good. And I don't think since we did that, I mean, all of a sudden, like, it was just like a wave of relief. So we started playing all the different songs, and we rehearsed a certain amount because we didn't know how many we'd get to play. And then we did the concert in November 2011, and my mom was in a, you know, rollator. Paul was in a wheelchair with the oxygen. It was very moving. My brother was there, Steve's sister, all the relatives. And people hadn't seen it. There were people there to see Peter and Paul from Peter, Paul and Mary. There were other groups that were playing besides us, but we really had quite a few people in the audience. It's like a converted church. So we played on stage, and we came on second. Pete Fornatale is a great DJ, who of course you know quite well, knew quite well, was introducing us, and of course Steve was saying, "Are you nervous?" And I would say, "Well, you know, no, I mean, you know, I played a little bit in between here and there. I would get up in front of people, but I said, you know, these are our friends. You know, what's the worst that can happen?" So we got out there. Pete introduced us and talked about how we were from Mount Vernon and not from Gun Hill Road. A beautiful introduction. We started playing. Audience applauded. All of a sudden, we were back in the day, and by the end of the night, we were on stage playing This Land Is Your Land with the whole group of musicians, Peter and Paul, and Peter was turning, and the guitar hit me in the head, and the string hit me in the head, and Steve was hysterical, and we were backstage talking to the guys, and all of a sudden, it was like, we miss the camaraderie of, you know, of being with fellow musicians and being on stage and performing for people and how much we loved it. And so that was the initial seed of it. It was not anything planned that we were going to do it. So after that happened in 2011, you know, I went back to California, and a few months later, my mom got sick quite, you know, suddenly. She was like 90 years old, but it was a quite sudden illness, and her heart sort of was giving out. And I had to go back east, and my mom was in the hospital room. And it was like a crazy movie of the week, a very sentimental movie of the week. But there was my brother and sister and myself. We were playing this Gun Hill Road compendium. They re-released the second album on Wounded Bird, which we also had nothing to do with. This was right before the reunion. A re-released Gun Hill Road album came out, all remastered. So we were playing Sailing, and my mom was, you know, singing along, and my brother and sister. And it was like, I mean, it was very moving to me, because here are these songs that I had written and the group had done. And here was this horrible, most horrible experience that you have to go through when you think you're going to lose your parent. And my mom has got her little hands on the restraining bars from the bed. And so I, before she went to bed, I said, well, you know, Mom, maybe I should get the band back together. Maybe we should record again. And all of a sudden, this really strong voice, why not? And I said, oh, okay. Well, and then my mom passed away a couple months later, and I was feeling pretty, you know, low down or whatever. And then when I started to recover a bit, I remembered what she had said, and I said, well, I wrote Steve an email, and I said, would you want to try and find a studio in New York and see, maybe we should get back together and record again? Steve wrote back, are you serious? And then, you know, I wrote him back again, and I said, yeah, why don't you look for a studio and see what it would cost or whatever. And he said, you're kidding, right? You know. So we started talking. He found a studio. We got back together. I went back east. We started doing a bunch of songs, five songs that Steve had written over the years, and a bunch of songs that we had played back in the 70s, but had never recorded, you know, formally. And then some new songs I'd written in the interim when I was working at Hanna-Barbera. I would write songs just for fun, you know, just because I love writing songs. And we started rehearsing them, and all of a sudden we went in the studio and we started playing them. We never said we're going to cut it down, so that's why there's 19 songs. We never said we're going to cut this one out. We're going to cut, because we figured we may never get back in the studio again. And it was not calculated. It was just, we're going to see what it sounded like, and we had no expectations beyond that. So it's just been a labor of love from the beginning. I mean, Steve's wife would bring food in every day. She would go to the delis and get food, and it was just fantastic. People would drift in and out of the studio, and it was wonderful. I mean, Steve said it was the best 2.5 weeks he'd ever had. I mean, we laughed. It was fantastic. It was just the power of music to bring people back together, and a continuity that went all the way from our teen years all the way to our mid-60s. It's very, very special.
That's Glenn Leopold of Gun Hill Road. We're talking to Glenn Leopold and Steve Goldrich of the legendary band Gun Hill Road, consisting of Glenn Leopold, Steve Goldrich, and Paul Reich. And taking us up to the break, let's listen to a song from the album written by Steve Goldrich called Stop, You're Moving Too Fast.
Stop, you're moving too fast. You're moving too fast. Stop, you're moving too fast. Stop, you're moving too fast. How many times must I tell you I can't keep up with you? Time and again you persuade me to do the things that you do. I won't demand that you change your behavior. I'm just your lover, your living neighbor. Stop all your fussing and stop all your crying. I'm taking over, there's no denying. Stop, you're moving too fast. Stop, you're moving too fast. Stop, you're moving too fast. You do. Life in this bright light city is slowly killing you. I could be caring for many others, keep my appointments with nighttime lovers. I could be keeping the hours you keep. Party all night without any sleep. Stop, you're moving too fast. 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 Stop, you're moving too fast.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and a special edition of A Touch of Gray. We've been talking with Glenn Leopold and Steve Goldrich of the legendary band Gun Hill Road. And we've come to our final segment. I want to mention again, if you're interested in anything having to do with Gun Hill Road, their music, the video about their history, visit the website GunHillRoadMusic.com. And that's GunHillRoadMusic.com. Finishing up our conversation, Steve Goldrich. Steve, how does it feel at this point now, at this age, to have done this project, to be out there doing interviews, to have some radio stations playing the album? What can you share for people listening about doing something like this in your mid-60s?
There is something about doing or having another opportunity to do something you did at a much younger age, which I don't think most people ever have. And one of the greatest things about this is getting back together, of course, again, with the group. Glenn and I talk all the time, Paul and I talk, etc. But the actual experience of being able to relive something 40 years later is so otherworldly to us and to me that there's only good from this. And the reward I could almost say was us doing our get-together 3 years ago, having this new album out, of course, goes well beyond that. And in enjoying this in a place at a level that I don't think anybody could really appreciate at 20 or 21 or 22 years old when we were doing this.
We're talking with Steve Goldrich and Glenn Leopold from the legendary band Gun Hill Road, who have a new album out called Every 40 Years, 19 Original Tracks. If you want to find out more, how to buy the album, or learn more about Gun Hill Road, go to the website gunhillroadmusic.com. That's gunhillroadmusic.com. And here's a song from that album, very apropos to today's economy. It was written by Glenn Leopold from the album Every 40 Years, Gun Hill Road, and Selling Apples.
Heard you lost your job, that's why you're standing on the unemployment line. And there's such a mob here, I've been trying to catch your eye for quite some time. Cause you don't have to worry about your future. Darling, you will found a faithful friend.
Fabulous words. We can be happy selling apples again. Glenn Leopold, Steve Goldrich, and Paul Reich from their brand new album, Every 40 Years, Gun Hill Road. Thank you guys for joining us on the program. Thank you to Carol Marks. We'll be back next weekend right here. Same time, same station. On behalf of all of us, thank you to Beverly Santanello, our producer on the front line, and thanks to all our affiliates across the country, and of course to our listeners. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.
People stood on bread lines just to try and